know, I just ended a relationship, a 14-year relationship at my age. You know why? After 14
because
years,
niggas ain't shit.
I recognize he don't love me the way I want to be loved.
Okay.
I just don't want to be loved like this. See, I don't get to tell people how to love me. Mm-hmm. I get to see how they love and then choose if I want to participate. So for 14 years, I was hoping, okay, he's going to get it. 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 And then I said, you know what? He ain't getting it. And it's okay. I don't choose to participate in the way he loves. I got a bunch of degrees, and it took me 14 years to get that. Thank God I couldn't get pregnant. So, you know, you get to make that choice and look at carefully and consciously and honestly, ruthlessly, what you did and how you did it so that you don't do that ever.
Again. To the Black Sublime Podcast. This your host. It feels so good to be back. It's your host, Mr. Haberdashery, aka Aeolus White, aka you better hide your nigga come June. Hide your man come June, baby, because I'm ready this summer. No, I'm playing. I'm not playing, but I'm not going to take nobody, man. I'm not. We not on that anymore. It feels like, you know what's crazy? Like, my black ass has not done this in 6 months. It has been 6 months since I've been on the microphone. It's been six whole months since I've been here. And it feels so good to be back. It's like I never left. You know what I'm saying? And I think I was procrastinating. I'd been not dreading it, but nervous that I would lose my love for talking shit. Like, I would lose my love for running my mouth. And, like, I would just not want to do this shit anymore. And then as soon as I heard my drop, like, as soon as I heard my drop, it was just, I came back in full force. I'm so thankful for people, to everybody who has been waiting and reaching out. There are people that have been, I've been looking at the numbers, people watching the old episodes. I'm just so thankful for that. Anyone that's shared the content, anyone that's put people on, it's just thank you, because my ass hasn't been on the podcast, hasn't been doing it. Iyanla. You know, it's funny because, you know, I drink water, bitch. If you listen to the podcast before, you know, I will mid-sentence drink some water. So if you new to the podcast, my bad. But I think Iyanla, I mean, what she said in the beginning, and I normally don't even put posts, do clips that long, but I felt like I needed to include the entire piece. So if Iyanla comes for me, I mean, she comes for me. But I really wanted to touch on what she said, because I realized that same shit. And I realized it without seeing the clip. I wish I had seen the clip. One of my friends, an old friend of mine, told me to watch this show, and I only watched clips. I never actually watched the whole shit. And had I watched this before, I might have saved myself some years. You know, I think what she says about not being able to tell people how to love her, I think that language probably is a little misleading, because obviously you can set standards for yourself. Obviously you can set boundaries and ask your partner to, you know, respect those or whatever. But I think that, you know, I think more accurately would be that everyone's love is like an art. Love is like a craft. Love is a skill. And that's what I'm going to talk about this episode, because y'all probably like, where the fuck this nigga been at? And I'm going to tell you where I've been. I'm going to share that with y'all. Love is, you know, a fruit that you bear from your own activity, like from what you do, from how you are. Like, it's gonna have like this. I think I mentioned this on a podcast before that, you know, bluest eye, the way Toni Morrison ends the bluest eye. And it is true, you know, it's love is something that you hone. You know, it's something that you practice. It's a craft that you sharpen. It's an activity that you become better at. But we all have our styles of it. Just like as a singer, I have my style of singing. As a songwriter, I have my style of songwriting. As a poet, I have my style of poetry. Even as someone who speaks and who fashions sentences, like, I do so in the way that I do so. Love is similar, and, you know, it's not that it's that individualized, but it is that if someone loves you, if someone is loving in a way that does not feed you, it's best to leave. Like, you know, I was talking to one of my homegirls, and she was saying, oh, but this guy loves me. He loves me. And I told her, I was like, stop thinking about whether or not he loves you. A lot of times we get caught up in that truth value. Like, he said he loves me. So, you know, the fact that he loves me is enough to endure dissatisfaction, misery, loneliness, whatever. I know he loves me. At least somebody loves me, right? But ignore that. Yes, he loves you. Take it, you know, don't be like, he doesn't really love me. If he really loved me, he would do this, you know, whatever. Take as fact that he loves you. The next question is that love enough? Is that love good? Is that love feeding you, nurturing you, you know, helping you grow? And what is that love doing for you? Is it doing anything? Or do you find yourself having to work even harder, right, to try to get him to love you in a way that is healthy or nutritive to you? I had those thoughts, and, you know, and on this podcast isn't about, this episode is not going to be about anyone else's love, frankly. It's really going to be about my own. And I'll share some things that I've read, some things that, you know, I've written. I gotta stay hydrated, bitch. I'm sorry. Things that I've written in response to this, thoughts that I've had, you know, just, you know, whatever. But about 6 months ago, maybe five, I realized that the same shit that we all have heard before, that I was in love with potential, or that I loved potential. And it's not just the potential of an individual. It could be the potential of an institution, an employee. You know, I think I naturally have that caretaker, that teacher guide mentality, like where it's like I see someone and I can see their potential, so I want to help out of just, you know, or not even just someone. Like if I work at a place and I feel like we could be doing better, I'm just going to want to make it better. Like, I would not be satisfied with just being an employee at an institution that I felt, you know, could be killing it. And I realized that the only person's potential I needed to be worried about was my own. And that I had a sense, an intrinsic sense of my gifts and an intrinsic sense of my abilities, but I hadn't looked at myself with that same loving objectivity that you look at a student or a friend or a partner or whatever, but you see them clearly, like, you're capable of so much. You know, you just, I thought I knew what I could do or what I was good at or whatever, but that's a different gaze. It's like, there's an objectivity that's required, or that we give to others, because we're not them. Obviously, we're not biased by being subject, right? We can look from the outside and see. And I was like, am I really invested? Am I invested in my own potential? Am I invested in realizing my own potential? Am I loving myself to fruition like I would love someone else to fruition, right? And I found that I wasn't. I found that I struggled with a lot of things that I hadn't healed from, and not just traumas, but, or not the big traumas, but things that kept me from, you know, things that fed into fear, and we'll go into that. So I set out on this journey. I was like, I didn't start the journey until January, but in October, I started to really contend with this potential problem, and I started to really, really try to investigate this within myself. And I decided that what I would do, this probably happens around December, I decided that I want to become a master of love. I want to develop a mastery of love. And not that I'm going to bust it open and dick's going to be bomb for everybody. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, because it's important to say that, you know, the hoes are listening, you know. I'm not talking about erotic mastery, even though we love that. I'm talking about mastering my art and my craft of loving myself and others. Really being able to say I am a master at loving myself.
I should say
that mastery does not mean perfection. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be perfect every time I set out to love myself. I remember reading something, I think it might have been in Talents is Overrated, this book that I read a long time ago that, you know, or something like that. Yeah, that, you know, I read because it was one of the popular books of, like, the finance girls back in, like, 2011 or 12, and I read it, and it basically was talking about the influence of hard work and starting early. But it talked about Tiger Woods, and it talked about how he's a master of it, of golf, and him being a master is really that when he starts to swing, I don't know golf, so those of y'all who know golf, my bad. But when he starts to swing, he can... It's not that every time he starts his swing, he's perfect. It's that if he starts to swing incorrectly, time moves so slowly for him as he does this that he can correct the little micro errors that might influence his swing or whatever the language is for that. And I thought about this, like, as a singer, how I kind of understand that I'm not a master vocalist, but I'm good enough that I know when some shit's about to go left in my body or in my voice, and I correct it so that it doesn't go left. Or, like, you want singers when they start to go for a note, but they know they don't have a note, but they know they don't want to sound crazy, so they pick another note, they just choose something else. Or people that improvise and they just have the skills. Like, I love improvisation. I just love that shit. I think it's the test of Black musicianship. But, like, the ability to just choose another alternative, I think that that's what I would be calling for loving myself in terms of being a master, right? Like, I should be able to fucking, if I know that my day is going trashly, it would be an adverb, but whatever. trashly, or my day, or if some shit, I said some negative self-talk to myself, like I'm about to do some negative self-talk or whatever, I should know how to switch it. I should know how to love myself into a better place. And the truth through. It's like I was nowhere near that, and I hadn't developed a practice to get there, right? So I started to read, and I'll talk about the art of loving. I think I'm gonna talk about the art of loving now. I could go into Polysecure. There were two books that were really influential. Really two and a half if you include The Body Keeps the Score. But I remember talking about The Body Keeps the Score before. That's why I'm saying a half. That really, the way they work together in my mind shifted my perspective, right? So when you start with The Body Keeps the Score, I took a lot from that, but the main thing I took from that was that my body on a physiological or neurophysiological level has changed in response to trauma. I thought that, and that was important to me because it felt like when you talk to people and when I talk to people and I have these conversations, people have made me feel like, and I have made others feel like, that it's only on the ideas level. So if you don't have confidence, or if you have some shit, whatever, I can just tell yourself, have a mental image that represents what you're trying to achieve, and hold that image and you should be good. And obviously, I mean, I'm kind of being reductive here because I've never said that, but it's kind of like when you think about therapy sometimes and talk therapy, and it's like, why don't you just write something down? And not that that doesn't work, because it does, but write something down, think an alternative thought. If you have a negative thought, just think an alternative one. And yes, but you need repetition, because when you experience whatever you experienced that made you engage in that negative talk, it literally changed your brain. So in order to change it back, or to change it into something else that's healthier, you have to engage in repetitive action that will take, it will take a long time. It is not as simple as, you make a chart where you write down the ways you catastrophize, then you write down alternative scenario to that catastrophication, that catastrophization, what I'm talking about. And then you get money. No. Your body has changed. And I investigated or interrogated the ways that my body had changed to a lot of the stuff that I dealt with, and how I normalized that, or how I just got used to that. So that's kind of the backdrop. This materialist, I'm saying materialist because I'm thinking about philosophy, but this, real like physiological approach, or the physiological truth, which is why I'm thinking of materialism, of like this problem, like this real, my body is different because I went through this. I carry stress, I carry tension, blah, blah, blah. I sound this way, I hold my head this way, like my muscles carry X, like neural pathways that are beneath the consciousness have shifted because, it's like that. And when I realized two things. One, that I got a lot of work to do. Two, that when somebody tells me that they're going to change and they're not willing to put in a long time of repetitive work, that you should not believe them. Sorry, buddy. And it's not that they're lying, because it's not about deceit, or it's not about deceiving me. It's about deceiving themselves by not understanding the nature of the problem, right? You have to understand the nature of the problem. When I was like 24, I used to say that it takes at least 18 months to stop doing toxic shit. Because I realized I didn't have this neurological background, but I realized that if you really about to change some shit, you gonna fuck up many times, right? Like, you're gonna, I hate when my computer does this shit. You're gonna fuck up many times. You're gonna backtrack many times. And the person that you're riding with, the person that's on your side, that's holding you down, may suffer from every time you backtrack. You know, every time you backslide, backslide is what I'm looking for. Every time you backslide, your wife, your partner, your husband, your friends, your mom, your ex, whoever's intimate with you may suffer that consequence. So for you to say, oh, I change, I'm just going to change right now and we're going to be good, is not realistic, because we not going to be good. You going to fuck up. I'm going to fuck up whatever I'm working on. And I just ask for grace until I get to a point where I no longer fuck up and I can try to build things to protect you from my fuck up. You know, that's going to be what I work on, insulating you from when I fuck up. But the nature of intimacy is that, you know, our proximity makes you vulnerable to my fucking up. So I need to say realistically it's going to take me 1 to 2 years before we can never worry about this again. So that's the backdrop. Then I feel like I read Polysecure next, which I won't really go into because it's a lot. But I will just say that I thought about attachment, you know. The way she frames attachment theory really, really helped me. It really helped me because, you know, I've studied psychology in school and the girls were always talking about attachment this, attachment that, and it entered the mainstream. And a lot of people say it. Like, I saw it in magazines. I saw it all over the place. So I kind of ignored it because I'm that kind of girl. Okay? I am that kind of girl where when somebody is talking a lot of shit about some shit, I just think it's bullshit by default. I mean, I'm working on that. But I'd be like, nah, like in school, I was always, if everybody got something, I'll want it. Like, I'm just that kind of person. I have been that kind of person. I'm changing. So I had kind of dismissed attachment theory as something that would be useful for me. And so, but reading her, obviously, like exploring polyamory and understanding what that comes with, it is kind of like, you know, as if you're exploring polyamory, you kind of need to become a master of intimacy, a master of attachment and managing attachment, because it's challenging enough to be in a monogamous relationship, especially if you're exploring non-hierarchical polyamory. So you have everybody's needs matter and you're not putting anybody above anybody else. It does require you to be able to manage your needs, manage other people's needs, and really get this attachment shit together. And she talked about a lot of things. I'm going to skip over a lot of it because I want to do a whole episode on attachment. But yeah, the main thing that I will say that as it relates to my progress with love is, you know, I needed, it made me understand a lot of how the way that I am. Or how, whatever. It gave me not a justification, but a fair description of my childhood and my young adulthood and how it was so refreshing to read the exact ways that I did cope with something. Because, you know, sometimes you feel crazy as fuck. And she nailed a lot of my coping strategies, so shout out to her. Moving on, I did want to read some of my excerpts of Art of Loving and also my journal entries about the Art of Loving, because, you know, it dawned on me, one of my homegirls read the Art of Loving before I read it, and she didn't get anything out of it, which was interesting to me, because, you know, I'll just say that I understood why she didn't get anything out of it. For me, I understood why I got a lot of it, you know. So, and when we spoke about it, she was like, oh, when you framed it in a certain way, it hit different. And I was like, oh, I can see that. So I kind of wanted to share some of my framings of it and how I digested it internally. And then after that, we still have time. We'll have time to do a lot of shit. Because I do miss y'all. I'm talking fast, though. Because I got a lot to do. And not just to do outside of this, but it's been so long. Like, and to sum up 6 months, I'm not going to be able to. Let's just call it spade a spade. But, you know, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Okay. So, holla. Oh, okay. So, I'm trying to think about where to start because I'm not going to give all of this shit. Yeah, I mean, I'll start with generosity. Ooh. And generosity is important, right? And I'm going to put generosity, safety, and exploitation in this, like, trio of concepts. Because for me, they relate. Well, in my experience, they are related. You have generosity. So let me just start from where how he goes into what he says. He says, giving is the highest expression of potency. In the very act of giving, I experience my strength, my wealth, my power. And for me, I don't like thinking about wealth and power. That's not really true. I just think like the words stress me out because I'm traumatized by capitalism, which is something that we're going to talk about. I'm traumatized by capitalism. So like words like work, labor, you know, wealth, power, I'm like, ah, bitch, I'm good. So the way I translated it spiritually on that day was I give because I am able. And I thought about all the things that I give and that I'm able to give. Like, aside from the money that I'm able to give, leadership, thought leadership, empathy, you know, creative like product. It doesn't really cost me anything. Like, obviously there's labor attached to listening empathetically and being like sharing. It's difficult in some ways, but I don't have to exercise effort to start it. You know, as somebody interacts with me, if they're speaking from the core of their being, if I am open, I will experience some of their emotional life. Like, I am a thought leader because I just am one. I think about these things all the time. So I don't have to like put a lot of effort into thinking about these things or and finding a language to express those things. Like, I'm naturally good at language. I've been a nerd my entire life, but I've always loved language. Like, maybe not always, because apparently when I was a kid, I didn't speak. But, like, you know, which is probably a coping mechanism. I probably was like, these niggas out their minds. but, I mean, like, you know, 8 years old and on. I just got to thinking about that. Seven, eight on, I've loved sentences, grammar, poetry, vocabulary, etymology. I used to read the dictionary like a loser in sixth and seventh grade and write down the Latin roots of words. Like, who the fuck does that? Who does that? So I've always liked that. So it just makes sense to me. And I give because I can. And it doesn't cost me anything. It's just, I just do it. Whereas I watch other people who are have to lead, are put in a position of leadership, or who, you know, have to emotionally and empathetically connect to someone else, or who have to, like, when they're put in this position and it costs them so much. Like, just the question of how to balance my needs and someone else's needs. Like, they need help to figure that out. And I'm like, you know, yeah, I just can. I mean, when I'm loving myself, I can do that without issue, which is why I do it. I mean, I think, you know, I think, obviously, that caveat, when I'm loving myself, so that's kind of why this whole project has come about. But, you know, it's not hard. For me, it's not hard. The issue is when you interact with people that it's difficult for, and people that don't have a self-love. So it's difficult for them on period because of maybe their experience, their lack of experience, their trauma, whatever. And then they don't have a self-love practice or a way to re-energize themselves. That's when you lean to an exploitative place. And I think some of that is gendered, which I'm going to sidestep, but you understand what I'm saying, that a lot of my natural gifts, particularly the emotional ones, are categorized typically in a feminine space. So, the masculine people don't have the gifts and tend to exploit them. So, in my experience, I've been exploited a lot by masculine people, and also by feminine people who have been so traumatized by masculine people that they reproduce their behaviors. I worried about being exploited, so much so that I stopped being generous. I worried about being safe and being able to keep myself safe because of real traumas, so much so that I am afraid to be visible, which makes me afraid to be generous, because, like, you kind of, like, in the world that I occupy, and also in a lot of this bullshit social media, blah, 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 you kind of, when you're giving, you kind of have to be seen, not necessarily seen giving, but if you're hiding your hands, you can't extend it, right? I mean, that's just, so, you know, there's, though, that kind of thing that I needed to work through, and I thought about how it affected my love style. I thought about how it affected my love style, and, you know, maybe here I will put a little note on the Poly Secure book, because one thing that she said that relates to this directly is that people with the attachment style that I exhibit had to navigate being afraid of their attachment figure and naturally loving them and naturally wanting to be close to them. So, you know, because their attachment figure was, you know, so overwhelmed with their own emotional states and being unable to attune to them, or having moods that were unpredictable, or just being a victim of a lot of things that made them unable to keep themselves stable. You didn't know what you were going to get when you approached them. You didn't know if they were going to have room for you or not emotionally. You didn't know if you were going to be lashed out at. You didn't know if you were going to be ignored. You didn't know what you were going to get. So you naturally, as somebody who's attached, wanted to get close to them, but you also held fear in that same place. So you often retreated. So you grew up having the stress of wanting to be attached but not being able to fulfill that, and because of the fear. And I was like, you know what, bitch? And she talks about, like, you know, how when you have that background, like, it can be difficult for you to self-regulate, like, deliberately in public. So a lot of people with that attachment style feel like they can only soothe their own anxieties by retreating. So they soothe their own anxieties alone. And I was like, check. I was like, bitch, yes. Because it's not that I'm introverted. You know, a lot of times I co-opt introversion. And I think a lot of people do this as well. Like, I co-opt introversion because it's convenient and it's there and everybody knows what introversion is, so it's fine. But truthfully, like, I would probably be an extroverted person. Well, I probably have the tendency, the capability to draw energy from social gatherings, but I also kind of lack the ability to find peace in public, find, like, calmness in anxiety-free, you know, zen in public, because, you know, you learn to self-regulate in public with your early attachment figures. And, you know, so I go home when I want to relax. Like, when I want to chill out and I want to be zen, I just stay zen in my home. And that all influences, like, how I choose to love myself and other people. Like, the opportunities I give myself and others. So we touched on generosity and the attachment thing, because it's important, because I linked those two ideas because, you know, the visibility, the safety, the hiding my hands and extending it, that sentence, which I thought was a good one, really kind of mirrored the approaching and retreat that you would see in the attachment style that I mentioned. But I didn't name it intentionally because I wanted to save that for an episode. What else? I wanted to... He talks about... So, The Art of Loving, the author is Eric Fromm. It's important for me to say that. He says... So, here's what he says about the ability to love. It presupposes... So, it being the ability to love. It presupposes the attainment of a predominantly productive orientation. In this orientation, the person has overcome dependency, narcissistic omnipotence, the wish to exploit others or to hoard, and has acquired faith in his own human powers, courage to rely on his powers in the attainment of his goals. And, you know, for me, that was interesting. And I'm always speaking absolutely, but I know that I do pretty well for myself, like, in a lot of these things. But to say that somebody's ability to love is contingent on a productive orientation. So a productive orientation is not, you know, checking off. Like, it's, again, I feel like we're traumatized by capitalism, right? Like, a lot of us, when we think being productive, we think about the shit as defined by corporate lingo and stuff. But he really talks about productive as in being beneficial to others in your environment. You know, helping, or not necessarily helping, but like I said, being beneficial to others in your environment. To, and for me, you know, and when he says in our orientation, that person has overcome dependency, a lot of people have spoken about what it meant, have spoken about what it means to be codependent, narcissistic omnipotence. Like, he talks about narcissism later in the book, but essentially, I think that might be important to just jump to real fast. Let me see if I can get that quickly. He says selfishness and self-love, far from being identical, are actually opposites. I wrote in my margin, selfishness is the evidence of the absence of self-love. He says, you know, that self-centeredness is it basically doesn't allow you to see things objectively, which is a key part of being able to love others. You know, you're unable to observe things as they are. That narcissism makes everything that you see pictures formed by one's own desires and fears. He says, it is true that selfish persons are incapable of loving others, but they're not capable of loving themselves either. And I think there's a lot of truth to that that I won't go into because I don't want it to turn into shade, but it's 100% true. Okay. From experience with niggas, it's 100% true. So there's that. But it's like, you know, he says, going back to what a predominantly productive orientation is, you know, you have to overcome the wish to exploit others, which I think it's easy to succumb to in this environment because that's what capitalism is, right? And I don't think I'll have time to go into that. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. I don't know. We're going to see. Or to hoard, which I felt like I was hoarding, not whoring. Not whoring, but hoarding. And has acquired faith in its own human powers. That to me was huge. Because I thought about faith, and that's another conversation. But he means confidence. And I considered myself confident. Because, you know, I had insisted on and I continue to insist upon my own self-expression, the manifestation of my being in public. I have fought authority. I have, you know, if you know, you know. I'm never like, you know, I stood up many times. But I realized that despite that, I have confidence in my abilities, the ones that are valuable in the marketplace of this culture. The ones that I have been shown through elitism, upward mobility, etc., that could change my life and the life of other people, economically speaking. The ones that make me more attractive in this romantic marketplace. But I don't have the kind of confidence and the kind of belief in myself that is stable, that is permanent, that is omnipresent, that applies when I am tired, that applies when I that is strong enough to fight self-doubt. I don't have that when I am vulnerable, when there's something that I care about that I might not be perfect at, that I might feel like I'm not a master at, that I really want, that my dream, like the things that I dream about and that make me feel full but small but large, you know, the things that are everything, I don't have confidence in. And even the things that are not that big, you know, what it means to you know, how hard is it for me to go on a long run or some shit? Like, well, that's not really a good example, but lift something really heavy. You know, I have a lot of trauma around working out. Like, you know, it was traumatic. A lot of the gym and that kind of thing is traumatic for me because of just what it meant to be me, you know, as a young person, like in sports and have my feelings privately and not, you know, feel, you know, just in that toxic masculinity, like that was not a good place for me. You know, that shit was all, like, negative. And not even that they were bullying me or anything like that. This energy was toxic to me. And then self-effacing is a better word than toxic in that environment. And then it's like, then going into the gay world as a perceived man, oh my God, it became so tied to beauty and, again, the marketplace and attractiveness, not about health or well-being or your feeling of being capable and believing in yourself. And that just became about people wanting your body and the number of people that could want your body, increasing your value. Also toxic. So I was like, girl, it's just, I'm good. But it was like having faith in myself, even on that level, I didn't have. You know, I watched this video. It was a meme where this kid was like trying to run up a half pipe looking type thing, and he couldn't do it. And then his dad says, you know, take a break. Picture what you want to achieve in your mind, and when you're ready, just go as hard as you can. And he talks about like him, like something about him believing in him. And I was like, no one walked me through that. And I was happy for the kid, obviously, but I was like, he has his dad, like an invisible hand on the back, on his back, pushing him up the, you know, up the half pipe, there pouring into him, expressing belief in him about something that he's failing at. And I was like, in my growing up, it was like, if you failed at it, don't do it. You're not good. And I do feel like there's a culture, there's a little bit of a black culture there, but you know, we gonna not deviate off the topic. But I do think there's some of that there. And I was like, it's so beautiful to see that. But anyway, needing to do that for myself. And then he says, courage to rely. So this is back to the predominantly productive orientation. He says, courage to rely on his own powers and the attainment of his goals. Yeah. It just resonated with me because in loving people, I have seen this time and time again, and I would never say no shit like because somebody doesn't seem. I mean, actually, I have said this, so I'm lying. I've said this actually the exact sense that I'll say that I would never say, but I have said, you know, somebody lacks courage, so they would be a bad partner. Someone doesn't have belief in themselves. Someone is too, like, insecure, so they wouldn't love. I've said these sentences, but I've always felt crazy. I'm not gonna lie to y'all. I felt crazy as fuck, and people have made me feel crazy. So it's not just me. You know, it sounds mean when you say some shit like that. You know, people hear, oh, I lack courage, so you think I'm not gonna be a good partner. Are you calling me a bitch? And you're saying because I'm a bitch, I'm not gonna be good? I mean, yes, that is what I am saying, but I don't mean it like that. You know, I'm not saying that you aren't, who, girl, with something on my face? Let me see, because that's the last thing I need. I don't mean it like that. You know, I it is, though, that if you lack courage or faith in yourself, some of that is going to pour into your love style. It just is going to. And you can find somebody who can deal with that, but it's going, it is going to affect it. And I think one of the things I love about this book is that it made me feel less crazy, which is obviously a completely selfish thing. Like, who the fuck cares? But I needed that because a lot of things that he says resonated. He talks about the common elements of love being care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. The way he defines responsibility is important. And I think I'm gonna, let me see what else I want to say, because I'm running long. Hey, not me, stop. Yeah, I'm gonna just say this quickly. I think the way he defines responsibility, when he says, you know, part of responsibility is being responsive and not just responding to needs that have been expressed, responding to needs that have not been expressed. I think that sometimes we live in a culture, or sometimes this culture tells us that we are only supposed to get what we ask for. You hear this a lot when we talk to people and they're like, you know, I'm not a mind reader. And you know, this is usually masculine people saying, I'm not a mind reader, right? Because masculinity, and we're going to go into that next episode, masculinity does not have much, right? As a concept, it does not have much. So, you know, you hear that a lot. You know, I'm not a mind reader. And although, yes, it is true that we must express ourselves, it is not the case that as a person that wants to be loved, you know, you're only going to get what you have asked for. You should, if somebody loves you, they should be responsive to needs even when they're not expressed. This culture of, you know, we must use our words to get things, to be loved, to be seen, to be responded to, for us to be legitimate, is crazy. And I've always felt like it's crazy. It's this weird legal, it's very legalistic, it's very penal, you know, a penal like type of shit. Like, if I love you, I am supposed to respond to you. Period. Like, whether or not you say one thing or the next, I'm supposed to. And my style, my ability to respond to you is going to be linked to my other abilities. If I am not observant, if I am not, you know, disciplined and able to concentrate, which is, you know, ADD, that's a whole other thing. But if I'm like, you know, if I struggle with peace within myself, if I am overwhelmed with my own needs and my own, and that's what I mean by focus on other people, not like concentrate, you know, on tasks. But if I am so overwhelmed with my emotional life that I can't hold space for you, then how can I respond to your needs if they're unexpressed, especially if they're unexpressed? And the problem is, instead of teaching people to manage their needs alongside other needs in a communal context or whatever, we teach them to just be like, well, she ain't say it, so I'ma just keep doing dumb shit. You know, and I just, you know, so that's, I wanted to say that. He talks about care, responsibility, respect, and knowledge. I am going to skip all of that. And I wrote a lot of shit in response to the book. I think I'm going to save some of this for the next episode. But I did want to talk about some things he recommends in love. What I just said was, you know, it's some kind of like penal, legalistic like framework or conception of love. He talks about fairness being a poor proxy for love. That's not exactly his language, but he does talk about, he names fairness. I said poor proxy, which I would say poor proxy, but he forgot the language he says. But he talks about sometimes how we, you know, settle for fairness instead of achieving love, and sometimes we just call fairness love, and I think that goes to the whole responsibility point, where it's like people are seeking agreements that are inherently unequal. But because we've agreed to it, and because we have come up with stipulations that are semi-appropriate, potentially appropriate for the circumstance, and that's questionable, we've agreed. So now it's fair for me to continue to act in this way. And, you know, It's not. I mean, we don't have the time today to get into it, but I do want to return to this because I think that it grounds the conversation that I want to have next. Next week, if I remember, you know I'm good for making... I'm good for saying I'm going to do something next week and then not, because life happens and you change topic and I think about new shit and think about it in a different way and whatever. I do think this time I will, because I've been thinking about this for a long time. So, I mean, that's what it is. But... I want to talk about masculinity. I want to talk about black masculinity in particular. Really the masculinity of anybody that doesn't have access to capital. And I wanted to ground the conversation in love before going into that. But yeah, I'm going to let y'all go. I want y'all to have a lovely week. I'm going to release this on a Friday, which I've never done before. But I think you know, we trying something new. I'm not going to be as consistent as I've been in the past. I'm going to just release things as I am ready, as long as the content is good. So I want to spend a little bit more time editing the video, a little bit more time being strategic about like where to place things, figuring TikTok out and how that relates to this. And, you know, I want to get it right and less than just stressing out and not putting out something that I'd want to put out just because it's Tuesday. But I want y'all to have a lovely week. I want y'all to get it popping for me, because I've been keeping it cute. You know, I want to live vicariously through y'all. I'm excited to be back, and I love you, even if I'm saying that you.